Radio free readout begins in 5, 4, 3, 2.
This is Radio Free Redoubt. I'm John Jacob Schmidt. My name is your name, too, if you're a God-fearing, liberty-loving patriot. Thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you had a blessed week. More than that, I hope you had a blessed training exercise this weekend with T-Rex 2017, the nationwide disaster preparedness exercise, a scenario-based training exercise. And this year's scenario was based on a massive earthquake that scientists are saying is going to happen. It's a matter of time. They don't know when, of course, but we always need to be prepared. And we were working on that, being prepared this weekend by working toward radio communications for disaster situations. And it was a great, great training exercise. Lots was accomplished and lots was learned. Plenty of challenges as well. Most of them actually were very expected with the band conditions being what they are, but we're wiped out. I'm pooped and energized at the same time and really encouraged by the progress that was made, the camaraderie that happened and the team building that took place. Several of us, well, like seven teams across the country deployed together, multiple operators deploying together to act as signals centers, to work together as a team to handle the traffic that was being passed across the radios. And multiple groups took to the field with their families and friends to simulate a grid down situation. Some of them just made a camping trip out of it. Many of you put your generator and your off-grid power systems to the test. You were cooking off-grid, just experimenting with your gear and having a great time together and learning a lot. And so thank you guys for doing that. I'm going to talk a little bit about that probably in the next segment. And then I'm going to put together an after-action review for next weekend. And we're going to be giving away some gear next weekend. All you have to do is take the survey, which we have posted. I'm going to talk about that in the next segment. In this segment, well, there's a lot going on. So let's get to the news and commentary, which is brought to you by the author Glenn Tate and the 299 Days book series about the partial collapse and the rebuilding. Go to 299days.com to learn more and stick around because in segment three, we're going to interview another author, an up-and-coming author, Shelby Gallagher, who lives in Oregon, and we're going to talk about next week's eclipse that is going to be carving a path out across the United States, visible only in the United States, and it's going to draw millions of people. So really interesting take on that. In the news, of course, we were grid down, completely cut off from the internet, but we were connected to an internet of radio operators who were keeping us apprised of real-world situations, one of which was this blowout that happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. Antifa and BLM and some right-wing groups, apparently some neo-Nazis and everybody else is mad at each other, and somebody plows a car into the crowd that we're still trying to get more information from. It's still, you know, preliminary enough. We're hearing, you know, this is a right-wing extremist that plowed into this group of Antifa people. Other reports are this was actually an Antifa person going to the demonstration and was attacked with sticks and rocks by Black Lives Matter and sped off to escape and plowed into a crowd. So all of the misinformation, disinformation, and poor information is all swirling around. But here's the bottom line. Stay away from crowds. Remember, we are hurling toward a civil war. We are extremely polarized. And that's being helped along by agitators on the left that are anti-American, that are accusing conservative American citizens of being hateful while they themselves are engaged in hate and extremism. So stay away from the crowds. Keep prepping. Keep preparing. Be prepared to protect your life and your community and your family. Be prepared to be self-reliant. We've got this situation really heating up with North Korea. So, and I want to talk about that a little bit. I'm not going to get into the Antifa thing. Look, we're deeply divided. We're extremely polarized. Our nation is becoming balkanized. And if we are going to use history as any measure, we are headed toward major conflict, to include armed conflict in our country. So just be prepared to protect life, liberty, and property if you are forced to. And now learn to be self-reliant. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, preparing for war, and discuss some of the things that other people that have gone through war-torn nations as they go through changes and how you can survive that. And of course, I'm an optimist. So I like somebody pointed this out. The same symbol, I don't speak Chinese, but the same symbol in the Chinese language apparently for chaos is the same symbol that's used for opportunity. And that's what I see. Of course, it might be chaotic, but it also provides opportunity. And that's how I look at it. A chance for a new beginning, a chance, the chance that we need, the reset, wiping the slate clean. We need to be prepared to take action when that opportunity arises. So we're talking about war with with North Korea. Now, we are at AMCON 3, real world, because of this situation in North Korea. You go to amron.com, click on the AMCON 3 banner, and that will take you to the page that explains why we're there and what we should be doing about it right now to kind of prepare ourselves. And somebody on social media said, well, they're saying all kinds of stuff. I'm not even going to get into that. Okay, so apparently an analyst said there's no good option. A senior intelligence official involved in North Korean planning told NBC News, but a unilateral American bomber strike not supported by any assets in the South constitutes the best of a lot of bad options. The attack would consist of B-1 Lancer heavy bombers located at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. Apparently, of all the military options President Donald Trump could consider, this would be the one of the two or three that would at least have the possibility of not escalating the situation. That's a retired Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander Europe and NBC News analyst. And he's saying the B-1 should be the best one to be used because military sources are telling NBC News that the justification for centering a strike on the B-1 is both practical and intricate. The B-1 has the largest internal payload of any current bomber in the U.S. arsenal. And they're saying that it has extended range, highly accurate missile. Wait. More likely, according to military sources, the new joint air-to-surface standoff missile with an extended range is a highly accurate missile with a range of 500 nautical miles, allowing the missile to be fired from well outside North Korean territory. The B-1 also has been selected because it has the added benefit of not being able to carry nuclear weapons. Military planners think that will signal China, Russia, and Pyongyang that the U.S. is not trying to escalate an already bad situation any further. So here's something to think about, though. I mean, they're snubbing their nose at the United States right now and threatening to turn us into jelly. That was from Kim Jong-un on Friday. Says he will attack the United States and turn us into jelly. I mean, that's a serious threat. Nobody wants to be turned into jelly. But here's something to consider. The DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, usually celebrates each national holiday with some kind of missile test or nuclear weapons test. Now, tomorrow, that's the 15th of August, is one of those days, Liberation Day. So we'll keep an eye on that. And we've got a list here. We're going to post this, a list of public holidays for North Korea. They always seem to want to fire off some missiles on that day. And of course, Trump's basically said, you fire off another missile, it's on. So we'll continue to watch this. Really interesting, isn't it? Sam Culper from Forward Observer weighed in. He's got this early warning for 14 August 2017 newsletter coming out, the Forward Observer intelligence analysis. Apparently over the weekend, well, let's see, Charlottesville, he mentions this. Let's talk about North Korea. National Security Advisor McMaster calls Charlottesville violence terrorism. They don't even know yet. That's shooting from the hip. But as North Korea warns of a second Korean War ahead of a joint U.S.-South Korea military drill later this month, CIA Director Pompeo said that nuclear war is not imminent. And I agree, it's not imminent, but it is. The probability is highly increased. Each week, Monday to Thursday at 8 p.m. Central, Forward Observer will bring you new indicators of war, domestic conflict, and systems disruption. You can check that out by going to fomag.com, Forward Observer. Oh, and what do we got here? Talk about Islam. The community is invited to come and learn from Nick and Laura Armstrong of Boise as they discuss refugee resettlement in the United States. And they're going to be giving this little speech in Sandpoint, Idaho, North Idaho, right in Patriot Territory. The Armstrongs co-lead in an organization called GLOCAL. That's not misspelled. In partnership with World Relief, another Islamification organization. They basically prostituted themselves, contributing to the invasion by Islam of our country for a profit. And the International Rescue Committee, another one. The primary purpose of their work is building friendships and welcoming the stranger. And of course, these guys are Christians, so they're using scripture out of context. We've covered that before. What they mean, what is meant by the stranger, the foreigner in Israel. When they said, welcome the stranger, to take care of the sojourner. The word that's used, the Hebrew word, is not just somebody just coming into your country. It's someone who has said, your country is my country, your God is my God, and the God of Israel is my God. That is the word that they used to describe that is what they meant. Not somebody coming in from a culture whose doctrine calls for a jihad, the overthrow, the overtaking of your country through immigration, like Islam has called for. So these guys are, let's read, so often fear and rumor guide our opinions and decisions. And sometimes truth and objectivity and an understanding of history guide our opinions and decisions too. We will hear firsthand how refugees are screened, not, that'll be propaganda and misinformation, how they gain legal status and get admitted to the U.S. Nick and Laura will also share ways communities and individuals can help refugees become citizens. Refugees are not immigrants looking for better lives in the U.S. Refugees are people fleeing for their lives from war and political or religious persecution. Then you know what? Give them refuge until their country stabilized, and ship them back. If they're not looking, how many times have we heard from Muslims, you know, that I don't want to come to the United States. I don't want to go to Europe. I want to live in my country. It's just war torn right now. Well, then great. You don't need citizenship then. A shelter, place to stay, as soon as we stop meddling in that part of the country and it can be stabilized, then you get on a boat and get back home. A plane, it's faster. But we need to talk about how to bring them. Basically, it's just a propaganda presentation to get citizens to accept, through misinformation, accept the Islamification of their communities. Thanks, but no thanks. They don't belong here. They just flat do not. Now, you're supposed to go out into the world to spread the gospel. That doesn't mean bring the enemy into your home. Because what's happening is, oh, we'll bring him here. We'll share the gospel with him and convert him to Christianity, when we know that actually it's the other way around. We have people in those host nations that are actually converting to Islam. The Muslims there are becoming radicalized, and those who hold the traditional values of that culture are becoming increasingly persecuted, especially Christians, and well, especially Jews and Christians. We don't want it here. We don't need it here. I support the underground church in the Muslim countries. They're the ones that need our support. They are converting Muslims. That's who we should be supporting. Not bringing them into our home and converting our children to Islam. Cyber threats prompt return of radio. Radio operators, listen up. Cyber threats are prompting the return of radio for ship navigation. Out of Reuters, the risk of cyber attacks targeting ships' satellite navigation is pushing nations to delve back through history and develop backup systems with the roots in World War II radio technology. That's a little misleading. It's, yes, the key word there is roots in World War II radio technology. That means HF radio, high frequency radio. But World War II, the roots of World War II radio technology meet the 21st century. We're using computers, we're using software, air-gapped computers not connected to the internet, with programs that allow us to send email and text and images back and forth using World War II rooted radio technology. Yes, over the airwaves, HF. We made it happen this weekend when band conditions were cooperating. There is a new jihadi magazine now. No, it's not new. It's been out for several years. I've talked about it in the past. I have several copies of this, tracking this. It's called Inspire. Interesting. Inspire is designed to do just that. Inspire Islamic jihadists to carry out lone wolf attacks. Well, we've got the new one out. And they're calling on lone wolves to derail all kinds of railways now, commercial and chemical, and of course, passenger rail trains. They're providing plans how to make a derailer, how to scout them out, best times to do the most damage, etc. Got some pictures from the magazine here. We'll probably put this up. We'll post this. With there being so much railway unseen by the public, it'll be hard, but my guess is that they want to maximize damage and the loss of life, so it would mean they would be trying to look in populated areas. Just beware. So, yeah, I agree. We do have these images here from the Inspire magazine showing rail routes where passenger trains travel, and a breakdown of all the rail systems in the United States, and which rail line operates which, or which company operates which lines, and so on. So, man, you know, I wonder if we could, you know, get a hold of Homeland Security and get a Islamic on the rails shoot on site policy put in, Homeland Defense policies. You know, I'll tell you what, you could add some incentive and patrol a huge portion of our rail systems they would just empower and allow the citizens to provide for a lot of our own homeland security, put an end to a lot of this nonsense. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. Come back and talk a little bit about T-Rex. And then after that, segment three, we'll be with joined by Shelby Gallagher. Gosh, I'm tired. I know I sound like it, too. I apologize. All right, stay right there. We'll be back in a minute. There's something going down.
This is Matt Shea with your daily news commentary the way I see it. The 51st state, Liberty State. There are a lot of myths going around, and one of them is we would fail as a new state because those of us in rural eastern Washington are just a bunch of welfare freeloaders. They say this because we get more money in services than we raise in taxes. That's rich. The truth is that a new state would be nowhere near the size, scope, and socialism we currently see. It would have nowhere near the regulatory or tax burden on small business and workers. It would actually be a place businesses and people would move to. So downtown Seattleites can call hardworking people in rural Washington all the names they want. We know the truth. Hard work and liberty means prosperity, and like-minded businesses and people are drawn to wherever that's fostered. And so while those downtown Seattleites sip their lattes before the next socialist protest, we'll be hard at work building a new state that preserves liberty and freedom for our children, at least. That's the way I see it. This is Matt Shea. Thank you for listening. Paid for by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican.
Are you aware of your water rights? Water is one of the foundational elements of life and a resource that you must have ample access to if you are going to make your property a viable place of self-sufficiency. For those who are considering purchasing property, keep in mind that in some states, water rights can be sold separate from the land and don't always automatically transfer with the property purchase. So it's important to be sure that any existing water rights are included in the terms of your property purchase agreement. If no existing water rights are in place for your land, obtaining water rights should be a top priority. Let's face it, the longer you wait, the more stringent and limiting the government regulations are likely to become. This is Brian Domke of Strategic Landscape Design, helping you live a life of liberty.
Welcome back. This is segment two, which is brought to you by Selkirk Mountain Real Estate. Patriots helping other patriots get strategically relocated into the heart of the American Redoubt. If you are looking at the northern part of the panhandle of Idaho, give Selkirk Mountain Real Estate a call. Check them out, selkirkmountainrealestate.com. All right, let's get into a little bit of T-Rex here. I'm just going to spend a short time talking about it, and we'll get moving on to the interview. But something came up before I jump on that. There's an article on Survival Blog about this poly mule handcart. Now, when I travel, when I go on road trips and stuff, I got this. It's like a jog behind stroller. Because I got to think, man, you know, I got a lot of gear. I've got comms gear. I've got my rucksack. I've got, you know, just equipment and weapons and stuff like this that I travel with. It's really more than you can practically carry. So I got this fold up, just goes right in the trunk. This little run behind little three wheel, little jogging workout stroller type thing. But it holds all this gear. It's usually like you can hoof it down the road pretty easily with this. Got it from a yard sale, and there's something that just came out. It's really cool, and it's called the Poly Mule Hand Cart. And at first, I was like, "Nah, not really interested." But what I like about it is it all snaps together. It all like it's like Legos. It all locks together without any tools. The need of any tools, and it breaks down, and the whole thing goes into the cart body, and so right into the trunk. This is really cool. Poly Mule hand cart. So anyway, he's got this website, the Poly Mule website. they're trying to crowdfund it, and they're down to like a week. The Polymule acts as a modern handcart, allowing individuals to flee on foot with more than they could ever carry on their back. That's true. That's what caught my eye about this. It was built to tackle tough terrain, long distances. Completely toolless design, can be assembled in 2 minutes. All the pieces fit inside the handcart body for transport. And so he was asking if there's any way we can get this out on the radio show. And his name is Dennis. And I'm impressed. I checked this out and thought, absolutely, I'll help spread the word. If go check it out. If this is something that you think might be useful for you or applicable in your, it's kind of like one of those game carts, you know, that's for, you know, hauling out deer or quarters of elk or whatever, you know, a wheeled cart. But this thing is, it's compact. It just breaks down and it assembles so quick with no tools. And that's what I really liked about it. Just drop it in the trunk of your car. So, really cool for mobility. And, I'm going to check it out a little bit closer, but they're crowdfunding it right now and they're coming down to the wire. So I thought, yeah, this is something that could be useful, especially ham radio operators carrying a bunch of gear over terrain and, backcountry or trying to get into remote places. It might be a really good option for you guys. So go ahead and click on that link in the highlights and resources posting, or just it's tinyurl.com/polymule, P-O-L-Y-M-U-L-E, polymule. Pretty neat. Now, somebody asked a question on Facebook. Talk about communications here. He asked, what would be the best way to get more people involved in what we do? I appear to be the only person in my county and out of communication distance until I get licensed from the closest members. I've upgraded my monitoring abilities over the weekend, but wasn't able to participate in T-Rex as much as I wanted to. A few more closer members would have helped as far as relaying goes, in my opinion. Well, you're absolutely right. You already identified the first hurdle you need to overcome. You've got to get licensed. Why do you got to get licensed? Because you cannot legally train, and they'll stomp on you if you don't, if you're not FCC licensed, you get on the air. It's pretty self-regulating. Hams are going to pounce all over you. You have a whole world that opens up in front of you when you get licensed. You begin developing relationships and meeting people on the air. You can actually start working with these tools, which you must work with to get proficient. Every one of these ham operators over the weekend, they will tell you, if you do not train, you will not communicate. Things are going to happen. Murphy's going to show up. You must know how to troubleshoot your equipment. These guys that are very good radio operators, and there are many of them now, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years ago, they were not licensed. Many of them didn't even know what amateur radio was. Now they're some of our top operators. You know what the difference is? Well, they got licensed. But then there's a lot of people that are licensed. There are people with extra class licenses that just got their first Baofeng and they're asking for help how to program it because they don't know how to go to YouTube and actually develop the skill themselves. So when you, the difference is training. That's what makes a good radio operator. And when you train, you build up experience. That experience built up allows you to be as self-reliant as possible. We're big proponents of self-reliance. You don't have to jump on a forum. You don't have to jump on an app and ask to be spoon-fed something that you should have known because you should have been practicing and training for the last year. And T-Rex is actually the test. It's a chance for you to implement the things you've been practicing for the last year and to actually go grid down and actually make contact over the air and only over the air and put your stuff to the test. And when it fails and when you can't make contact, you reach into your toolbox that's been filled up with tools based on your experience and your prior training to get through problems, work through issues, make contacts, build your confidence, and put your skills to the test. So You definitely have to practice. Now, how do you get more people involved? Great question. This is a problem all over the country where there's Ameron operators all by themselves and there's nobody around in the network close enough for them to reach. Now, how did the network get built? It got built because people spread the word and they got other like-minded people involved. And that means you. If you're the only Ameron operator and you're waiting for others to join so we can put you in contact with them, my question is, why? Why are you waiting? There are some extremely effective and large and growing networks in Arizona, in Idaho, in Washington, in Georgia, in North Carolina, in West Virginia, where you can get on the air pretty much any time and get a hold of another Ameron operator. You know why? Because these guys spread the word. They get one or two of their friends or like-minded people in a, what they are, here's the difference. It's networking. If you do not have the ability to network with others, to build up a network of other folks like you, you're not going to fare very well. Those who are doing well, they have the ability to network. Now, maybe you don't, but your friend does. Get a hold of your friend. Get them on board with Ameron. Tell them the importance of being able to communicate in a disaster. Get them on board. Practice between the two of you. And hopefully you have a friend that is good at networking who can start spreading the word in your community and get people excited. Get them on board. Start building up your network. Hold regular nets. And it will, at a certain point, it will take on a life of its own. You just got to give it a little bit of a nudge. But that really comes down to you guys, individual Ameron operators in your communities spreading. There's no magic dust that we sprinkle over a community and make a local Ameron network grow. That is human intervention that takes place there. Human interaction. Now, how to kind of get over that hurdle. And I've talked about this before. I've written about this before, and one of the best ways to do that is to put on free training in your community. Host and put it in your little nickel or nickel's worth or nickel nick or whatever little flyer that everybody picks up, you know, when it comes out. Local Craigslist. Get involved with your local emergency preparedness networks. And these people have little workshops on canning, on first aid, going to the firearms range and putting on classes and beekeeping and things like this. We all know that communications is one of the most overlooked areas in the preparedness communities, other than tactical communications, very close up, handheld FRS type radios. They need to go to the next level. So what you could do is facilitate that type of a training, put it on for free, and introduce them to Ameron and the concept of having a network that they can be tied into for information to stay informed and to inform others. And get with a local ham club about putting on, you know, getting some classes, get some people licensed, and really just get people involved. Now, you get 50 people show up to a free emergency communications workshop that you put on and talk about shortwave radio receiving and scanner receiving and then two-way radios and a common plan for you guys to reach each other in an emergency and start talking about some of the other amateur radio possibilities that are out there, some of the opportunities and the equipment and technology now that is in amateur radio, you're going to get 50 people in the crowd. You're going to get 2, 3, 4, 5 or more people say, this is for me. And how do we get involved? Now, the most effective groups that I'm aware of also meet regularly. There are groups that meet at the public library and they will meet at some location or a business that somebody in your network has will make their shop available, have donuts and coffee and meet once a week. And you guys practice programming your radios, have a barbecue and an antenna building party, and everybody builds a copper J pole for their 2 meter radio. Teach people how to put on Anderson connectors and power supplies and building a coax. Have a little free segment on how to build coax cable and programming your radios and everything else. So that's how these guys that are successful, who are actually growing networks in their communities, are doing it. So there's just a few pointers, a few tips, and we'll readdress this. Actually, yeah, that's hopefully will help you out quite a bit. All right, now let's talk about T-Rex this weekend, just briefly, because I'm actually going to do a full after-action review, and I'll bring that up for you next Sunday on our weekly podcast. But I do want to highlight just a few things that kind of jumped out at me this weekend. The bands, we knew going into this, and I sent out an email to everybody in Amron Corps. Do not get frustrated. This weekend, we're expecting solar activity. The bands are horrible right now. The 20-meter band, which is usually what we use for long-distance stuff, is just annihilated. It's just garbage. We're in a solar cycle right now. We're kind of at the peak of that, where it's just really messing up amateur radio. It's not beautiful like it used to be, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago. And we're going to climb back out of it, but right now we're kind of in a slump. So I can talk to somebody, you know, from the American Redoubt, and I can talk to somebody in South Carolina or Florida, like we're across the street from each other on a VHF radio, crystal clear, loud, booming in normally. But right now, it's stations I can normally copy every single time. Sometimes they don't hear me, or I don't hear them, or they're just so far down in the noise, I can't make out what they're saying. We're just going to have to just suck it up and get through that, because that's just where we are right now. I told everybody, don't get frustrated. Do the best you can. We know that everything's unpredictable right now. And when the bands open up, be ready, because all of a sudden you'll have it'll be no traffic, and then the bands will open up and everything's coming through. And that's exactly what happened this weekend. Saturday, there was nothing going on. Now, we could have gotten frustrated and stomped, and this doesn't work, and this sucks, and Amron doesn't work, and ham radio doesn't work. We're all doomed, and we'll never be able to pass traffic. No, what we did was we continued monitoring the bands. We tried making contacts every so often, but you know what we did? We made use of our time. We built chokes, RF chokes, that stopped interference radio frequencies traveling down the power cords from the generators. We repaired some electrical connectors for some of the radios. We did some mounting of radios. We threw up an extra antenna that we thought might be helpful to us. There's a couple guys had problems with the radio, so we did some troubleshooting. We got organized. We got some people up to speed on their digital software and got it all programmed for them and set up, because they had never done that before. We went over scripts. We taught people how to build macros for your digital software. So you just hit a button and there's a whole paragraph that gets sent out over the air in text. Well, you do that by making a macro. So all you do is have to just hit one button and it automatically sends it, and you just sit back and sip coffee and watch your signal going out. It's pretty cool, but you got to know how to build macros, and it's super simple. But guys that know how to do it taught people who didn't know how to do it, and we made use of our time. And then the bands, of first I just switched frequencies over to from 40, which was performing about the best of all of them, and I switched over to 80, and there was this signal just screaming in full 100% copy, and we realized the 80 meter bands had just opened up. So everybody's on the air cramming all their traffic through they can. It was not on schedule. We didn't follow the SOI. Sometimes you have to, when the bands open, it doesn't matter if the official net's not supposed to start for another 2.5 hours. You don't know if the band's going to be open in 2.5 hours, but it's open now. So you drive all your traffic through, passing messages back and forth as quickly as possible. There were some people, oh, they're starting the net and it's not on schedule. That's all right. Because when the net is supposed to be on schedule, the band could be dead. So, you've got to be flexible and ready to shift a plan never survives contact with the enemy, right? At least first contact. A plan is for you to start with, and then you assess the situation and you adjust accordingly. So that's exactly what happened. And it was really cool. It was very encouraging when that happened. And, you know, we deviated heavily from the SOI, mostly because of the band conditions, you know, were driving that. We always, you know, tried to put out a net. We tried to put out information according to the SOI, but oftentimes the band conditions just weren't cooperating. All right, enough on that. Let's see, what else did we have here? Oh, this is really cool. Software-defined radio. We've talked about this quite a bit. And we've always had a SIGINT, a signals intelligence section of our detachment whenever we deploy to do, you know, training operations with several operators there together, working together. So much growth, so much happens. It's really a phenomenal experience. There's camaraderie is built. Friendships are forged. There's so many different people with backgrounds and various talents that you can't get any other way than operating side by side, eating, cooking meals together, sleeping next to each other, working on the radios together. One guy's got an electrical engineering background. This other guy, you know, is a computer, does computer programming or IT work. Everybody's helping each other out, and it's a really cool experience. It's a great experience. Well, every time we've had somebody who's just really into SIGINT, signals intelligence, but they've got software-defined radios, they're setting up all the programming, not so much talking. They might not be the best radio operator as far as two-way communications because their thing is just software-defined radio and pulling in signals. So what we did was we actually recorded like 2.5 terabyte hard drive, 3-4 terabyte hard drive, basically harvested the entire amateur radio bands in 20 meters, 40 meters, and 80 meters, monitoring all three of them simultaneously, the entire band, and recording it. So now what we can do is pull it back. We could play it back just like as if it were happening live. So if there's a transmission or a piece of traffic that we missed, maybe we switched over to the frequency and it was already in the middle of being transmitted, so we missed a huge significant portion of it, we could go back to our software-defined radio, pull up that section, key in on that frequency, and get the message. Now, another cool thing, maybe I should save this for next week. In case I forget, I'll just say it now. Here's a really cool thing. When you're recording the entire amateur radio band, you can click on one signal that you see on the waterfall, and you can listen to that message. But maybe that was the message that was intended for you. What you didn't realize is just a couple of kilohertz away was another conversation involving some information that was very significant and important for you to know, but you missed it because you were listening on this other frequency like you were supposed to. But it gives you the opportunity to go and kind of tune in on what was happening in other frequencies on the band. And that allows an analyst to sit there and kind of hop in on these conversations, and voila, you find a conversation where somebody's talking about this bridge being out and this train being derailed and this big green cloud of toxic fumes, traveling at a northwesterly route at 5 to 7 miles an hour. You would have had no idea if you couldn't go back and just hop in and just kind of eavesdrop on some of the other traffic that's being passed on the amateur radio bands. So that's something we want to expand in a little bit more. It's really more than one person. You cannot have communications and nets and be handling traffic and do that. In a team setting, you can designate a person to that task while others are handling traffic. So there's definitely a lot to be said about several operators all working in the same proximity to each other, working together, and being just so much more effective. There's more here. There's more, but you know, I'm going to save it. I'm going to save it for next week. give an overall after action review. And that's going to give people a chance to get their after action reviews into me. And I'll glean some of that. We'll pass some of that on to you. We're going to go through a bunch of pictures that we took. I took some video as well. And more pictures are coming in from Ameron Core operators of their stations as they were participating in T-Rex. Of course, we want to go through and sanitize those and remove any metadata from the pictures, and then also make sure that any personally identifying information is redacted and that it's all secure before we put it up there. So we'll be working on that this week. Anyway, next weekend, there's going to be a very rare solar eclipse that's going to take place, and it's going to go across Oregon, southern Idaho, and then right on across the United States diagonally, right off the other side in South Carolina. So we'd planned a road trip. I am going to be in southern Idaho, and I'll be meeting with some friends, and I will actually happen to be there during that eclipse. And I actually saw the eclipse when it happened, 35 years ago? I was in grade school. And they said, this is rare. This won't happen again for 35 years, whenever it was. And it will be in 2017, which in my mind was 400 years from now. You know, back in the 1970s, when they said in the year 2017, I mean, we should be driving around like the Jetsons and spaceships and, you know, transporting like Star Trek. But here we are. We're still using round wheels. And the eclipse is going to be next weekend. It's going to be real interesting. What's going to be interesting is the human factor, the reaction. And Shelby Gallagher kind of keyed in on that. It's kind of her mind's oriented that way right now anyway, because she's writing a book about the collapse from a single mom's perspective. I'll let her talk more about that. But interesting. The world's not going to end. Well, at least I don't think it's going to end next Monday when the eclipse happens. Or is that Tuesday? Monday? We're not saying that. What we're saying is where there's millions of people converging on places that are usually very small communities, people do stupid stuff, and we're seeing people do stupider stuff by the day. And you jam a bunch of hot, hungry, tired travelers who are not self-reliant into communities that have run out of fuel and food, and grocery stores and restaurants are closing down because they got wiped out by the locusts. It'd be interesting to watch people's reaction. Anyway, we're going to talk about that when we come back in segment 3. So I will go ahead and just let that play out and just end the show. So I will say goodbye right now. You guys have a blessed week. Be safe. We'll talk to you next weekend. This is the Voice of the American Redoubt. Good night. Hi, everyone. This is John Jacob Schmidt here to tell you about the 299 Days book series by lawyer and author Glenn Tate. Follow him through his real-life story of transitioning from middle-aged, unprepared suburbanite to full-blown prepper, tactical team member, and provider and protector of his family. Go to 299days.com to learn more.
Greetings, Patriots. This is Chris Walsh, broker at Revolutionary Realty, located in the heart of America's Great Redoubt, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I sell land and backwoods cabins to America's Patriots every day. Creeks, springs, timber, and game, good survivable property without natural disasters. The state of Idaho has a balanced budget, and our people believe deeply in the Second Amendment. Call me today at 208-667-1776 or visit me online at www.revrealty.us. I'll be glad to serve you, and God bless America.
Now, this guest we've got coming up, you guys have already been introduced to her from when we were in Prosser for the Northwest Preparedness Expo. Someone that author Glenn Tate has taken under his wings, and she has a story that I'm excited about seeing and reading and coming out. We're going to talk about that, but I'm talking about Shelley Gallagher. She is an aspiring author. She's got some work that's going to be coming out probably right about the first part of the year. And she just wrote an article that was posted at 299days.com. What does a collapse look like? And what we're talking about is the solar eclipse that we're going to see here in about 8 days. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event. It will only be visible in the United States, and it's going to cover a swath of darkness about 70 miles wide from one end of the United States to the other. Shelley, hey, thank you. Shelley, did I say Shelley? Shelby.
Hi, good to see you, or good to talk to you.
Shelby, it's really good to have you on with us, and it was really great meeting you back in May. And when I saw your name on this article, I thought, right on. She's in it. She's still writing and using her creativity. And this time it was in the form of an article. So
yeah.
This has generated quite a bit of discussion on social media. Some people are saying, the National Guard is going to be called out. The federal government's treating this as a national emergency as far as logistics and preparations go. And other people are saying, you're just Chicken Little. You're claiming the sky's falling and nothing's going to happen. So let's talk about this. What inspired you to look at this from a prequel, or a glimpse into what a disaster or SHTF type of situation might look like?
Well, what kind of inspired me is I live in Oregon, and so this is in the news. This is not just me making stuff up. This isn't me just, prognosticating that something's going to happen. It's in the news. We have our governor Kate Brown. It's not my imagination. She has called in the National Guard for August 21st for any potential mishaps that could happen. We have several county sheriffs who are along that 70-mile swath that you just spoke about that are warning people there could be breaks in the power grid. Cell phone coverage is going to go down. You need to be prepared. Have a week's worth of food. And then on top of it, all the restaurants, the hotels, because there is going to be, it's already been in the news, an influx of tourists and out-of-staters who want to see this amazing thing. So there's going to be a huge impact on the power grid, on the cell phone grid, on the sewer grid, all of those things. So if you are a prepper like you and I are, I'm looking at that going, I know this is not going to be the collapse, the 299 days sort of thing.
Right.
But it can be it can help us, I believe, and especially in your work that you do with comms, help us get almost be a dry run, a practice run. It will be about, I think, about up to maybe a week. I've heard from one EMT say the Wednesday before and the Wednesday after, that's when it's going to be the worst in terms of just interruptions to our normal daily life, whether it be electricity, whether it be whatever. We can use that as a practice run.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Okay, what am I going to do if the electricity goes out for 24 hours when it's 90 degrees outside? What will we do? That's what I see. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a nice, safe front row seat to see not a disaster, but human nature. When normal services aren't involved, when gas stations are running out of fuel, when there's restaurants are closing because they're out of food and there's no supplies for a few more days. Just to kind of observe that in a non-disaster setting can be very interesting. I will be in southern Idaho near the Montana-Wyoming border, and directly in the path would be a 100% blackout of the sun where I'm going to be. And I know the federal government is using the opportunity to do some testing on HF, high frequency radio, to see, how the airwaves are affected. And there's going to be a lot of ham radio activity. So that's interesting to me. But what I'm seeing is in southern Idaho, they said they are expecting approximately at least 1.2 to 1.5 million people flood into southern Idaho along that path. And I know that they're projecting the same thing in Oregon.
Yeah.
And because this is only, I remember when I must have been 10 years old, 11 years old. I was in the fourth or fifth grade when this total solar eclipse went through. We were living in southern Idaho at the time. And they said, this will not happen again for like 35 years or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are. But this is unique because it is only visible in the United States. So not only are people going to be coming in from other parts of the country, they're going to be coming from around the world, believe it or not,
right,
to come and see this. So, you know, you dump into a town of 30,000 people that instantly goes to 250,000 people for 4 or 5 days. I could definitely see shortages in a lot of things. Now, which leads me to this. People are saying, you guys are crazy. Just because the moon is going to cast a shadow, power is going to go out, and communications are going to go down. You know, you guys are you're off your rocker. But it's not because of the shadow. Mm-hmm. It's the human effect. And that's what the government itself is even bracing for. So, back to you.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Oh, another part of the article is that they are mobilizing parts of the National Guard in response to this. Someone said, you know, hey, you know, no offense, but all I see is National Guardsmen in firefighting outfits standing there getting a briefing. But that's precisely the point. They're talking about tens of thousands of people who will be camping along that path in the wilderness areas and public lands where we have extremely high fire danger and high heat. And so that's one of the things that they're concerned about too is wildfires. Have you are you hearing the same thing?
I am, you know, and I saw that on social media, and it's so funny. The article was from the Oregonian. The Oregonian is a major paper that comes out of Portland, and they're the ones that reported that Governor Kate Brown called in the National Guard, and they used a picture of firefighters for the picture. Which, and somebody's like, "Well, those are firefighters." You know what? That's what happens when you have urbanites choosing pictures for news articles.
Right.
I get that. But whatever. But that's, you know, let's not get off track there. She has called in the National Guard. But you're also right. And it goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning. It's not the sun going behind the moon that's going to cause this. It's the human effect. So all it's going to take for kind of that snap, that spark, literally, that could cause panic really is, okay, we have people, and we've had, again, I'm not making stuff up. There are sheriffs out in these counties along this path that have said, we are very concerned about the huge influx of campers, people who don't know how to camp safely in high flammable conditions when it's 100 degrees outside, and they leave a fire left unattended. There will be fire damage, and there will be human damage, and there, because of just this huge amount of demand on the infrastructure that government provides for us. It's firefighting, it's rescue, it's EMTs, it's ambulances. All it takes is for about two or three of those things to happen in a remote place. And now it's concerning because just the sheer number of people. And in the article that I wrote for Glenn on his page, I said, just let's make this up, because I was talking about in Salem, Oregon, which is like ground zero. That's the first major city that this eclipse will hit.
Right.
Just throw in a car accident on one side of the bridge that only has two passable bridges, and on the other side, the EMT vehicles are. All of a sudden, you have this choke point of rescue infrastructure and an inability to do the normal daily behavior that we do to rescue people and to help people. Just by the sheer numbers of people, it will be I'm not saying it's going to cause a collapse, but I'm saying it will create what you and I are saying, almost a preview. We can watch how people behave. We can see what will happen. We can see if the electricity goes out. We can, and it will help us be more prepared for when that day comes.
Right. Yeah, I know. Just picking one city, just Salem alone, there are two bridges to handle mm-hmm. what is going to be basically quadrupling or more the population there, with no hotels, yeah. And also everybody's going to be live streaming. And, so you have your cell phone infrastructure affected. What would cause the power to go out?
Honestly, we've had it here in the Pacific Northwest where, honestly, just high heat can do that. And just a high demand on the grid. That happened, when was it? I have a friend who lives in Michigan. He tells me 2006 or 2008, one or the other, where they were out of electricity for like 11 days because of just sheer demand on the system. So all of the cell phone chargers, all the laptops, every hotel room having an air conditioning going, all the Priuses that are plugged in, all of the, just double that on sure. the system, and that can cause a collapse in the grid, a temporary collapse. I get that, but it can do it.
Well, you brought up a good point. With two bridges, with that high volume of people, hundreds of thousands of people descending yeah. on just one community, because of its proximity to the freeway, it's easier for somebody just to zip up from California and just stop in Salem because it's right off
exactly.
the freeway. So, I mean, those urban areas, the rural areas and the fire danger and, that's a problem in of itself. But everything along the I-5 corridor, which have all these choke points, accidents on a good day bring those areas from Seattle all the way down through, Salem mm-hmm. to their knees, to a creeping
Absolutely.
Crawl. So, add a couple hundred thousand more people and then one accident where they're going to have even the footbridge is going to be blocked off so they can mm-hmm. move emergency vehicles. But
absolutely.
Very interesting. Now, have you heard anything about what restaurants or gas stations and these other services are trying to do to stock up ahead of time so they don't run out as quickly?
Absolutely. And a good example, and I just read about this. Again, you can just look in the media sources here in Oregon. The Bend Bulletin, it's the media outlet in Central Oregon, that kind of the next city. Oh, it's like Santa going across the country. I'm joking about it. But the next stop, the next kind of city where the eclipse is going to see a lot of influx of people is Madras, Oregon. Madras is kind of near Bend. And there was an article in the Bend Bulletin about how there's a diner there that has normally like 300 things on its menu. They're paring it down to 30 choices, and they are stocking up. And they've already seen kind of an influx already, an increase in volume. And they're paring down and making it so that they only have to stock up for about 30 menu items. And the gas station, same thing. Everyone's stocking up. And that was, again, interesting. Somebody on social media came out in response and said, well, I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing any stocking up. Well, it's because people don't store their food in the middle of a parking lot. They're going to store it where they can keep it. And, I just thought that was kind of a silly argument.
I don't see it, so it must not be true.
Say it again. I didn't quite hear
you. Oh, I said, I'm not seeing it, so it must not be true.
Exactly. I just thought that was kind of silly, yeah. And so, the businesses are preparing for it. And also, too, there's also been, because this is what happens in collapses. Again, the preview is already kind of starting.
Yeah.
Hotels are full, and hotels are doing price gouging. And there's a lot of complaints about that. People who booked a hotel a year ago at a reasonable rate are suddenly getting emails from the hotel saying, oh, we're going to quadruple the rate, and or you're going to lose your reservation. And so, of course, government is going to come in. There's going to be, an investigation, and a complaint's going to be filed and all of that. So, but these are things that happen in a collapse. Price gouging. You cannot tell me that a loaf of bread in Madras, Oregon on August 21st is going to be $2. I bet it will be
$5. Right.
The preview that we have as preppers is amazing.
Well, I think this is interesting just for an academic standpoint for us to just mm-hmm. kind of observe what's going to happen, because most people have not witnessed an environment where people are without shelter. They show up without a place to stay. They have no support network. The gas stations are running out of fuel. The restaurants, let me just tell you, in 2015, we deployed to provide emergency communications in the wildfires in Washington State. So mm-hmm. when we first rolled in to this town of called Tenasket, I'm guessing maybe 15, 20,000 population, maybe. The Walmart parking lot was packed full. There were people, there was cars on both sides of the highway where people were sleeping in their cars. There was not a hotel room to be had. At the middle of the night, we slept in our vehicles. The next morning, we went to a restaurant. The restaurants were all closed. They were completely wiped out. Mm. They had nothing to prepare for people. I think the only thing that was still left open was a Burger King. And otherwise, the entire town was just, you know, completely shut down. And so in that situation, there wasn't panic. There wasn't chaos and mayhem in the streets. But there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of uncertainty. People were getting agitated. And also the opportunistic criminals came out.
Yeah.
There was just a overwhelming number of vehicles being broken into at the hotels, people's equipment being stolen out of the backs of trucks, and people were loading up all of their valuables and throwing it in the truck and evacuating because the fires are coming through. And so that, you know, here they are, you know, sleeping in a tent or sleeping in the hotel, and everything they own, all their most valuable prized possessions, are getting ransacked by the you know, meth heads and other opportunistic criminals. What I see here with this situation is not so much a disaster. I don't look at this path of the moon where it's, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people literally are going to be converging on this path. I don't look at it as a disaster. I look at it as what you would see in a refugee crisis. If there's a major earthquake, say in the Cascadia subduction zone, they're expecting 1.5 million refugees from the west coast of Oregon and Washington to be flooding eastward toward the Idaho border or to eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, for safety, for food, for water, for medical care, things that are, you know, not available to them after a earthquake followed by the tsunami that the scientists are saying is going to happen. So what you have is a refugee crisis. And I think not so much a glimpse into a disaster itself, but the effects of the disaster in the terms of the refugee crisis that would take place. People that are, you know, have whatever they can carry on the backs, with whatever fuel is in their cars, it will take them as far as they can go before running out of fuel, and no resupply, no food, no, you know, infrastructure. So I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing to observe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, and the way you, absolutely, this can be, because that's where refugee situations actually create the crisis, in the sense of it's just the huge onslaught of a lot of people all at once. In the refugee situation, there's a desperation that comes with it that will be in this case for sure with the eclipse. But again, I think if you would agree with me, this is more of a dry run and a glimpse of what it could be like. So when we see, and you just said it really well, what's going to happen is that people are going to come here, they're going to go to near where you are, and there are people out there, I'm sure there are, that are like, hey, there's no hotels. Wait, the diners closed down because they ran out of food? Why did that happen? Diners don't run out of food. There's the normalcy bias that will happen. People are going to show up and not going to be prepared. And then all it takes is like a car accident or a grass fire or something that suddenly makes it just that much more worse than it normally would be.
Right.
And for those of us who prep, again, this is a good, wonderful opportunity, in fact, for us to watch, so that we can make what we prepare for that much better.
Yeah. In Washington and Idaho, there's discussion at the government level expecting fires. Like, it's a given.
Yeah.
And I know from personal experience, when there are wildfires, they block off highways. And, you know, you've got an area that has 1 million people just immediately went up to, you know, 3 million people. And they're all trying to get home, and highways are blocked off, And, you know, if services are running out of fuel and food and everything else, it could get very entertaining. But, you know, I'd look at this as just an opportunity, a learning opportunity just to observe human behavior and look at, you know, some of the and just out of curiosity, will cell phones be overwhelmed? What will happen to transportation, you know, with that many people in an area? I'm looking at this as a refugee dry run. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Well, hey, let's talk about your book real quick. Oh, and I want to just encourage anybody that hasn't seen it. If you want to go over to 299days.com, look for the article. What does a collapse look like? Salem, Oregon on August 21st, 2017. So look for that article. And we're here, if you're just joining us late, we're here with Shelby Gallagher. A new author. It's got a book coming out here, and Glenn Tate has been working closely with her to help her through that process. We got to meet her in May in Prosser, and that was just a really great treat. But let's talk about your book real quick. What is the name of your book, and what is the genre?
I'll answer that question first. It's a prepper series. It's a prepper book. The type that we all just enjoy and love and read all the time.
Kind of dystopian prepper type of novel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Super.
And where, it's what we all love. That's, yeah. And where it comes from, and this is, again, this is me just watching the landscape around us. I'm living in a state. I live in the state of Oregon, and that's the name of the book is a great state, not necessarily meaning Oregon, but I live in a state where I have government in my business a lot, and I'm watching our government in particular right now, and in the last year more so, really, really, really market media woo and romance women and children to get on government assistance. And you and I are a similar age. When we were kids, that I remember Ronald Reagan going that, you know, the best way to help someone is give them a job,
yes,
not give them government assistance. You know, that's where you and I come from. And so I'm watching our government and what they're trying to, here in Oregon, trying to get people on the Medicaid system, on government assistance, so that they can continue to get federal dollars, so that they can continue the cycle of assistance. And I'm sitting here watching this going, okay, and then we also have a governor that's starting to draw a line in the sand and get in the crosshairs of our current president. And the president and Jeff Sessions are all saying, no more money for you unless you start towing the line. And so we're having this battle go back and forth. And what's going to happen with all of these people that are on government assistance, specifically mothers and children? That's where it just becomes very moral for me.
Right.
Mothers and children, when a collapse happens, where is there going to be the most damage done? Women and children.
Well, the exploitation is just going to be mind-blowing.
It is. It is. So that's where it comes from. And the character is a single mom. She sees this happening. She's very tempted by that. And yet on the other hand, she's like, I will take care of myself. Nobody takes care of me. And this is very much me. Nobody takes care of me better than me. And that's who she is. And that's what takes her through her journey as a collapse happened in Oregon.
Wow. Now, is this the main characters, like a single mother doesn't have a prepper man in her life and she's just carrying all this on her own?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Super. That's going to be a very interesting perspective, because in all of these dystopian novels, what we're seeing is, you know, I love Patriots by James Wesley Rawls, but, you know, here's a group of three or four couples, no kids. They've all known each other and been prepping for, you know, 15 years since they were in college. They're all making six-figure incomes. It's like the perfect prepper, you know, world. But in all of these novels, you've got some guy that's leading his family, protecting them, defending them, guns, stocking up. You know, you've got the patriarch there that is leading his family through this labyrinth of, you know, disasters and what do you want to call it? The dilemmas. But the reality is there are a lot of single women, single moms that are concerned. I've talked to them that they're very concerned about, the whole system, caving in, and they are the man of the family. They have to be. That's all they have. So I think it's really going to resonate well with a large number of people that are really waking up, that find themselves in that situation.
I absolutely agree. And just to throw some numbers out there, we need to remember over 50% of children born right now in the United States are to single parents. This is there's going to be a huge humanitarian sort of crisis when that happens. And yet on the other hand, we as the prepper community have a great message to give as an alternative to families like this. And I almost think we have an obligation to. Yes, and I agree. So many of the stories are great, but we need to also equip women, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, because I do believe God made us to have men patriarchs in our family, but that's unfortunate. That's not where we're at right now.
Right.
But women have a great role, and we can equip them to, and I'm one of them, equip them to do great things and to make it so that when this collapse happens, there's not this great, I know people will die. Children will die because government is going to collapse. And that just breaks my heart. But yeah.
Well, there's two sides to that. First of all, if you look at what's happening in Venezuela right now and what we've seen in several other countries is they're so vulnerable to exploitation. You've got mothers prostituting themselves out or prostituting their daughters out just so they can make some kind of money or barter for food because they're starving to death or they need, 2 gallons of gasoline, to make it through the week.
Yeah.
And then, you have the predatory criminal element that will be trying to seize on, those type of exploitation opportunities. And the other side of that is the problem is because of that humanitarian crisis, it creates the impetus for the government or whatever forms as declares itself as a government or an international body here to save us is using the high numbers that you just mentioned of women and children who are starving and they're without. So we have to implement these emergency measures and using the emotional argument for confiscating property, for implementing control measures, for relocating populations, for disarming the citizenry. All of these things are going to be used implemented on the heels of, we have to save all these single moms and children that are vulnerable type of argument. So, you also have the government that will be exploiting the situation as well. I'm looking forward to reading this. So what type of time frame are we looking at?
We are looking at, I'm glad you brought that back up. I'm looking at the beginning of the year, first quarter of the year, for release. And, we were talking about offline, but beforehand, there's powers that be that I can't, if I could publish it tomorrow, I would, but there's a process that I have to go through. So, I'm hoping we're shooting for the beginning of the year, but if I can go back to one of the points you just said, I was going to joke with you, John Jacob, have you read the way you're speaking tells me that you obviously, this subject really well, but I bring it out in my book. Yes. Women will use sexual favors, unfortunately, to feed their children. They will use sexual favors to have a bartering system, and it will be awful. And children will become victims because let me throw this out there. And Glenn has talked about this as well. Human trafficking in Oregon. Oregon is known as the number one state for human trafficking.
Yeah, I've read that.
And we're talking about child pornography, all of that. When a collapse happens, that's just going to become 100 times worse.
Yeah.
And add all these elements in that are already here in place in Oregon. These are all things that are already in place, and it's just going to become that much worse. So, I'm going to joke with you. I have not sent you a copy of my current draft, but it makes it sounds like the way you're talking, it sounds like you have. But yeah, these things are all going to be part of a collapse. And yet, you're right. These things are happening in Venezuela. They happened in Bosnia, Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. And we have an opportunity as preppers to have an answer to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know there's a lot of patriots that are having, you know, similar discussions about developing proactively now, formulating a response for when that happens. Because, you know, there are other globalist minded people that are also formulating a response to a disaster and as if they are counting on it. And it will not be in our best interest in terms of liberty or, preserving or maintaining, restoring, Americanism, traditional Americanism. So we have to be thinking proactively about this, strategically about, our response. And down at the tactical level, every family has to become as self-reliant as absolutely possible so they don't find themselves in the situations where they're vulnerable to being exploited on, in a number of different ways, or to find themselves enslaved by a newly emerging government system, that's here to save us from ourselves.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Good stuff. I'm looking forward to it. And I've heard great things from Glenn too, about your work, your book, the story, the way that it flows. He says it's gripping. And I think it's just a fresh, new, different perspective, and I'm looking forward to it.
Very good. So, I'm too.
Now, where can we go? Of course, we'll have you on. When that gets published, we'll talk about it. I'd love to get a copy of it and go over and we'll do a review. But do you got a web page or something set up where people can kind of track your progress or you can interact with your readers?
Absolutely. Right now it's in social media, Facebook and Twitter. Shelby Gallagher, author, is on Facebook. You can come friend me on Facebook. Twitter, I think it's Shelby G. Author. Website is still in the making, but and if you go look in Glenn Tate's page, I should say, you can see I've commented there. And he and I have been resurrecting his I Miss America t-shirts, and we've been selling those, and we have a couple of events. We'll be having those out here soon. So you can come find me and link to me there. But, yeah, please. I love interacting with people because I get good ideas. And people come – and you know this. They come out of those places, and you meet people that have been in Bosnia, and they – or they've been in special forces, or they've been, and you get this really great, you hear the great stories. And it just confirms to me, we're not making this stuff up. This is true stuff. Yeah.
That's right. And no matter what the naysayers say, you have to stay on, focused on, what that conviction that was put on your heart to, see something, to be visionary enough, to see danger and, be prudent and take refuge and make plans accordingly and let the fools just keep suffering or going on and suffer for it, when the time comes. So, Shelby Gallagher, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here at Radio Free Redoubt. Just blessings to you and the work that you're doing and, the book is everything is getting wrapped up and that's coming to a close. We look forward to it. So, thank you once again. And, you just have a blessed rest of the summer, and we'll catch up with you later this fall, hopefully.
Sounds good. Thank you, John Jacob.